Toward the end of the 1950s, some rather unexpected changes took place in my life. My writing career had been constantly expanding. I had been driven on by my own compulsion and by editorial cooperation to undertake more and more tasks in greater and greater variety. And by 1958, I found that I could no longer do the writing I wanted to do and maintain a full academic schedule. The medical school and I came to an amicable understanding, therefore. I kept my title, Associate Professor of Biochemistry, if you're curious, and continued to do odd jobs, like giving several lectures a year, sitting on committees, and so on. In the main, however, I became a full-time writer and relieved them of the trouble of paying me a salary. For a while, it seemed to me that with virtually no academic duties and an infinite amount of time each and every day, I could finally do all the writing I had to do with plenty of time left over for fun and games. It didn't work out. One of Parkinson's laws is work expands to fill the time available. It did in my case. In no time at all, I found I was typing as assiduously full-time as I had previously been typing half-time, and I quickly discovered the Asimov corollary to Parkinson's law. In 10 hours a day, you have time to fall twice as far behind your commitments as in 5 hours a day. The worst of it was that just about the time I was arranging to make myself a full-time writer, the Soviet Union sent up Sputnik 1, and the United States went into a kind of tizzy. And so did I. I was overcome by the ardent desire to write popular science for an America that might be in great danger through its neglect of science, and a number of publishers got an equally ardent desire to publish popular science for the same reason. As a result of combining the two ardencies, I found myself plunging into a shoreless sea in which I am still immersed. The trouble is, it's all nonfiction. In the last 10 years, I've done a couple of novels, some collections, a dozen or so stories, but that's nothing. From the aggrieved letters I get, one would think I was doing this on purpose. I'm not. I try desperately not to lose touch with science fiction altogether. It's my life in a way that nothing else can quite be. There's my monthly article in F and SF, of course, but that's not quite the same thing. And so it happens that each short individual piece of fiction I managed to get the typewriter to put out for me is dearer to me in the nowadays of my dimness than in the old times when I did 2 dozen or more long ones a year. The machine that won the war is one of those that serves as my periodic proof to the world of fandom that I am, too, alive. First appearance, The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, October 1961, copyright 1961 by Mercury Press Incorporated. The Machine That Won the War. The celebration had a long way to go, and even in the silent depths of Multivac's underground chambers, it hung in the air. If nothing else, there was the mere fact of isolation and silence. For the first time in a decade, technicians were not scurrying about the vitals of the giant computer. The soft lights did not wink out their erratic patterns. The flow of information in and out had halted. It would not be halted long, of course, for the needs of peace would be pressing. Yet now, for a day, perhaps for a week, even Multivac might celebrate the great time and rest. Lamar Swift took off the military cap he was wearing and looked down the long and empty main corridor of the enormous computer. He sat down rather wearily in one of the technician's swing stools, and his uniform, in which he had never been comfortable, took on a heavy and wrinkled appearance. He said, "I'll miss it all after a grisly fashion. It's hard to remember when we weren't at war with Deneb, and it seems against nature now to be at peace and to look at the stars without anxiety." The two men with the executive director of the Solar Federation were both younger than Swift. Neither was as gray, neither looked quite as tired. John Henderson, thin-lipped and finding it hard to control the relief he felt in the midst of triumph, said, "They're destroyed. They're destroyed. It's what I keep saying to myself over and over, and I still can't believe it. We all talked so much over so many years about the menace hanging over Earth and all its worlds, over every human being, and all the time it was true, every word of it. And now we're alive, and it's the Denebians who are shattered and destroyed. There'll be no menace now, ever again." "Thanks to Multivac," said Swift, with a quiet glance at the imperturbable Jablonski, who through all the war had been chief interpreter of science's oracle. "Right, Max?" Jablonski shrugged. Automatically, he reached for a cigarette and decided against it. He alone, of all the thousands who had lived in the tunnels within Multivac, had been allowed to smoke, but toward the end, he had made definite efforts to avoid making use of the privilege. He said, "Well, that's what they say." His broad thumb moved in the direction of his right shoulder, aiming upward. "Jealous, Max? Because they're shouting for Multivac? Because Multivac is the big hero of mankind in this war?" Jablonski's craggy face took on an air of suitable contempt. "What's that to me? Let Multivac be the machine that won the war if it pleases them." Anderson looked at the other two out of the corners of his eyes. In this short interlude that the three had instinctively sought out in the one peaceful corner of a metropolis gone mad, in this entr'acte between the dangers of war and the difficulties of peace, when for one moment they might all find surcease, he was conscious only of his weight of guilt. Suddenly, it was as though that weight were too great to be borne longer. It had to be thrown off along with the war now. Anderson said, "Multivac had nothing to do with victory. It's just a machine."
"A big one," said Swift.
"Then just a big machine. No better than the data fed it." For a moment he stopped, suddenly unnerved at what he was saying. Jablonski looked at him, his thick fingers once again fumbling for a cigarette and once again drawing back. "You should know. You supplied the data, or is it just that you're taking the credit?" "No," said Henderson angrily. "There is no credit. What do you know of the data Multivac had to use? Pre-digested from 100 subsidiary computers here on Earth, on the Moon, on Mars, even on Titan, with Titan always delayed and always that feeling that its figures would introduce an unexpected bias?"
"It would drive anyone mad," said Swift, with gentle sympathy.
Henderson shook his head. "It wasn't just that. I admit that 8 years ago, when I replaced LaPont as chief programmer, I was nervous. But there was an exhilaration about things in those days. The war was still long-range, an adventure without real danger. We hadn't reached the point where manned vessels had had to take over and where interstellar warps could swallow up a planet clean if aimed correctly. But then, when the real difficulties began..." Angrily, he could finally permit anger. He said, "You know nothing about it."
"Well," said Swift, "tell us. The war is over. We've won."
"Yes." Anderson nodded his head. He had to remember that. Earth had won, so all had been for the best. "Well, the data became meaningless."
"Meaningless? You mean that literally?" said Jablonski.
"Literally. What would you expect? The trouble with you two was that you weren't out in the thick of it. You never left Multivac, Max, and you, Mr. Director, never left the mansion except on state visits where you saw exactly what they wanted you to see."
"I was not as unaware of that," said Swift, "as you may have thought."
"Do you know," said Henderson, "to what extent data concerning our production capacity, our resource potential, our trained manpower, everything of importance to the war effort, in fact, had become unreliable and untrustworthy during the last half of the war? Group leaders, both civilian and military, were intent on projecting their own improved image, so to speak, so they obscured the bad and magnified the good. Whatever the machines might do, the men who programmed them and interpreted the results had their own skins to think of and competitors to stab. There was no way of stopping that. I tried and failed."
"Of course," said Swift in quiet consolation. "I can see that you would."
This time Jablonski decided to light his cigarette.
"Yet I presume you provided Multivac with data in your programming. You said nothing to us about unreliability."
"How could I tell you? And if I did, how could you afford to believe me?" demanded Henderson savagely. "Our entire war effort was geared to Multivac. It was the one great weapon on our side, for the Denebians had nothing like it. What else kept up morale in the face of doom but the assurance that Multivac would always predict and circumvent any Denebian move, and would always direct and prevent the circumvention of our moves? Great space! After our spy warp was blasted out of hyperspace, we lacked any reliable Denebian data to feed Multivac, and we didn't dare make that public."
"True enough," said Swift.
"Well then," said Henderson, "if I told you the data was unreliable, What could you have done but replace me and refuse to believe me? I couldn't allow that.
What did you do? Said Jablonski.
Since the war is won, I'll tell you what I did. I corrected the data.
How? Asked Swift.
Intuition, I presume. I juggled them till they looked right. At first, I hardly dared. I changed a bit here and there to correct what were obvious impossibilities. When the sky didn't collapse about us, I got braver. Toward the end, I scarcely cared. I just wrote out the necessary data as it was needed. I even had the Multivac Annex prepare data for me according to a private programming pattern I had devised for the purpose.
Random figures? Said Jablonski.
Not at all. I introduced a number of necessary biases.
Jablonski smiled quite unexpectedly, his dark eyes sparkling behind the crinkling of the lower lids. 3 times a report was brought me about unauthorized uses of the annex, and I let it go each time. If it had mattered, I would have followed it up and spotted you, John, and found out what you were doing. But, of course, nothing about Multivac mattered in those days, so you got away with it.
What do you mean?
Nothing mattered, asked Henderson suspiciously.
Nothing did. I suppose if I had told you this at the time, it would have spared you your agony, but then if you had told me what you were doing, it would have spared me mine.
What made you think Multivac was in working order, whatever the data you supplied it?
Not in working order, said Swift.
Not really, not reliably. After all, where were my technicians in the last years of the war? I'll tell you. They were feeding computers on 1,000 different space devices. They were gone. I had to make do with kids I couldn't trust and veterans who were out of date. Besides, do you think I could trust the solid-state components coming out of cryogenics in the last years? Cryogenics wasn't any better placed as far as personnel was concerned than I was. To me, it didn't matter whether the data being supplied Multivac were reliable or not. The results weren't reliable. That much I knew.
What did you do? Asked Henderson.
I did what you did, John. I introduced the bugger factor. I adjusted matters in accordance with intuition. And that's how the machine won the war.
Swift leaned back in the chair and stretched his legs out before him. Such revelations, it turns out then, that the material handed me to guide me in my decision-making capacity was a man-made interpretation of man-made data. Isn't that right?
It looks so, said Jablonski.
Then I perceive I was correct in not placing too much reliance upon it, said Swift.
You didn't? Jablonski, despite what he had just said, managed to look professionally insulted.
I'm afraid I didn't. Multivac might seem to say, strike here, not there, do this, not that, wait, don't act. But I could never be certain that what Multivac seemed to say, it really did say. Or what it really said, it really meant. I could never be certain.
But the final report was always plain enough, sir, said Jablonski.
To those who did not have to make the decision, perhaps, not to me. The horror of the responsibility of such decisions was unbearable, and not even Multivac was sufficient to remove the weight. But the point is, I was justified in doubting, and there is tremendous relief in that.
Caught up in the conspiracy of mutual confession, Jablonski put titles aside.
What was it you did then, Lamar?
After all, you did make decisions. How?
Well, it's time to be getting back, perhaps, but I'll tell you first, why not? I did make use of a computer, Max, but an older one than Multivac, much older.
He groped in his own pocket for cigarettes and brought out a package along with a scattering of small change. Old-fashioned coins dating to the first years before the metal shortage had brought into being a credit system tied to a computer complex. Swift smiled rather sheepishly.
I still need these to make money seem substantial to me. An old man finds it hard to abandon the habits of youth.
He put a cigarette between his lips and dropped the coins one by one back into his pocket. He held the last coin between his fingers, staring absently at it.
Multivac is not the first computer, friends, nor the best known, nor the one that can most efficiently lift the load of decision from the shoulders of the executive. A machine did win the war, John.
At least a very simple computing device did. One that I used every time I had a particularly hard decision to make. With a faint smile of reminiscence, he flipped the coin he held. It glinted in the air as it spun and came down in Swift's outstretched palm. His hand closed over it and brought it down on the back of his left hand. His right hand remained in place, hiding the coin. "Heads or tails, gentlemen," said Swift.